It's time now to get behind the headlines of this week's Hendersonville Lightning with editor and publisher Bill Moss.
Good morning. The Lightning is on the streets. The Lightning is in your mailboxes. And it's Thursday morning, which means the Lightning is on the radio. I've got Bill Moss with me here this morning. We're going to get behind the headlines of this week's Lightning, the newspaper to pick up if you want to know what's going on in our community. Good morning, Bill Moss. Happy Thursday morning to you.
Good morning, Mark. Happy to be back here on Lightning Radio on Lightning Thursday.
Yes, sir. We got a lot to talk about. Let's get started with it, if you don't mind. Let's call our first segment this morning the development segment here on Lightning Radio. Lots of developments being proposed here in Hendersonville.
Absolutely, and we can even fine-tune that to let's talk about development, let's talk about senior housing and affordable housing and what you might call mid-rise housing. So a lot of these go up over two stories, over three stories.
Yeah.
In one case, six stories. And it is not necessarily charitably viewed by the planning board so far. So let's plunge into the tallest of them, a six-story proposal for a six-story, I think it's around 70-unit apartment building on the same property as a Fresh Market shopping center on property owned by David W. Royster III. He's owned that shopping center for a long, long time. And he claimed, by the way, when, of course, the inevitable talk about flooding came up, that none of the stores in his shopping center, he said, in the 30-some years he's owned it, has ever flooded. Water has never been in them. And that was viewed just about as you viewed it when he said that. And this, of course, this is behind. It's on the west side. It's west of South Church, and it also fronts that little bitty Israel Street, which is a substandard city street, hardly big enough for a big SUV, although it is two-way, that is behind the Fresh Market. So that'll place it for people.
Yeah.
If you know Israel, off of White Street.
And it is right there off of what will soon be the Acosta Trail.
Oh, it is. It fronts, it abuts the Acosta Trail as well, which is another, we talked about that in some other development ideas, that and that is one reason they want to develop this property and think this would be a good, very attractive housing development. This is not senior housing. This is not tax credit financing nor affordable housing. It'd be market rate housing, which they haven't mentioned how much, but, you know, it'd be up over the into the low thousands.
Of course. And so the planning board, so what is their...
The planning board, as the headline reports, cast a dubious eye on this idea for a variety of reasons. The Israel Street access was one part of it. Flooding was a big part of it. Access, the flooding, the city staff actually request it would be gated. The city staff, one of their requests was that it not be gated. Wasn't entirely clear why they didn't want it gated, but I think they wanted more. They didn't want that part near the trail maybe to be gated off that way, but it would be gated and fenced, and the developer in the state of North Carolina would have to agree to a condition that either the staff or the planning board or the city council proposes. At the end of the day, Chris Justice, the attorney for the applicant slash developer, you want this site developed. You want to have people close to retail and services. You've got a professional engineer who will be providing to your city staff documents that say we are not going to negatively impact what's there. This is flooding-wise, really, the context, pre-development, and we have to prove that to the city as a condition. The planning board was not denying, was not buying it. They voted. There was a motion to approve it made by planning board member Peter Hanley, who said they have methodology in place to deal with it, the flooding he meant. It's a fantastic improvement for that part of town, not just housing. The whole improvement of the area is going to be fantastic. And it would be. But a nice, as you see the rendering there, can't see it on the radio, but the six-story apartment. But that motion to approve failed 3-5. And then the next motion to recommend denial, there was one vote switch there by Planning Board Chair Jim Robertson. That failed on a tie vote. A tie vote is a failure on a 4-4 tie vote. The Planning Board Chair Jim Robertson, who is in the construction retail, He sells construction materials. He knows a lot about construction. He's also worked for Housing Assistance Corp. He's a big advocate of affordable housing. But he didn't like the fact that they're asking to develop 25% of the floodplain in an area that's already prone to flooding. So the flood situation was probably the biggest when you came down to the end, liability or negative factor that caused the planning board not to recommend. So it goes to the city council really with no, without either. It's not a recommendation to
or not
deny, because nor a recommendation, obviously, to approve.
So the city council could override and say, yes, it's okay.
City council can approve it. Yeah, the planning board is always, with some few cases where actually they get like site plan approval that doesn't go to city council. The city council is the authority on a rezoning.
And if the city council doesn't approve it, do the people who are planning this project, do they come back with another plan?
It's possible. Sure, it's possible. Yeah. Could it be smaller footprint?
Right.
They didn't. Well, actually, there was one comment. Planning board member Barbara Cromar said 60 feet is just too high. They could do that. I mean, there's going to be some point, I would guess they would say, of diminishing return, where if you can't get enough units in there, then you can't get enough rent to make over return on investment viable.
Sure, absolutely. Let's stay on development. Planners recommended denial of the senior apartments on 6. We've talked about this one already.
Yeah, this is some similar factors. Flooding was not one of them. But for this, three-story senior housing development across from Party Hospital and across from the YMCA, which seems in a lot of reasons for access to medical and fitness and pretty close to all kinds of retail in Laurel Park and obviously the city of Hendersonville to be a good location. The developer certainly would say so and did say so. So they want this three-story, 52-unit apartment building. This one is affordable senior housing, does seek tax credit financing, and that failed to get a positive recommendation in a 7-1 vote. So this one did not. This one goes to the city council with that vote to deny. And Mr. Robertson, again, he cast the only no vote on the motion to recommend denial, saying that the need for affordable housing is so great that the city ought to find a way to approve the application with conditions that address neighboring residents' concerns. And like I say, those include scale, that it does about the West Side Historic District.
Uh-huh.
There was one speaker resident there who's lived in the West Side Historic District for, I think it's 30 or so years, and her house is the 1920s. So it is a contributing structure, which she said would kind of be overwhelmed by a three-story building. Other problems, if you could see this, again, can't see it on the radio, but there's split parking lots. The parking lots are on either side, and so people felt like, the opponents felt like, if you went to one parking lot and you couldn't find a parking space, then you're going to load a lot of traffic unnecessarily onto Florida Avenue, Oak, and Justice, and maybe even 6th Avenue / U.S. 64. That was one of them. One of the parking lot cuts through. You can cut through all the way from 64 to Florida Avenue. The one on the west side of this apartment structure, it is dead-ended. It does not come out on Florida Avenue. So then they said, well, you'll have older drivers trying to back up. That seemed to be a valid point, among the valid points. There's numerous factors were brought up in opposing it.
So again, same question. If the city council denies it, do they come back with another plan?
I think some of these tax credit financing projects they're probably pretty tight in terms of the number of units they need to make it work. So I'm guessing, my guess is no. I'd have to run that all the way to the ground to interview the developer to find out. But then, should we go to two more?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
We actually have approval
recommendation.
After saying no to the 6th Avenue application, the board voted to recommend approval of a four-story, 78-unit senior housing development at 2620 Chimney Rock Road. That's near the Ballantyne Apartment development on the same side of the road as that. And that, as I say, is also tax credit financing called White Pine Villas for 36 one-bedroom and 42 two-bedroom apartments. And then finally, not at the planning board, but last Thursday night, winning a rezoning that it sought was the Housing Assistance Corp plan to build 60 apartments and 20 single-family homes on 19 acres in the what's called Apple Ridge development between Sugarloaf Road and East Prince Road on property that would be annexed into the city, and once again also seeking that tax credit financing, which makes it work. Apartments of 1, 2, 3 bedrooms renting from $422 to $1,172. Homes that the homeowner families, working families, would help to build of 1,100 to 1,200 square feet would cost $229,000. I don't know when we've heard a number that low for a house.
Right.
Which is about a third or so, half or so of what a market home of that size nowadays is costing in the county.
Wow. Interesting. So the city is okaying that one.
Like I say, that I think the other two tax credit financing developments probably won't happen if they don't get the tax credit financing. There are three applications for tax credit financing. Only one will be approved. That's acknowledged by everyone. But this one, the director of the Housing Assistance Corp has told the Planning Board and the City Council it could go forward. There are some other options there for this one to go forward without that state tax credit financing.
Okay. All right. Well, that's going to do it for the development section this morning of Lightning Radio. Coming back after the break, we're going to talk about the bomb threat at North Henderson High, Kanuka Conference Center, Flat Rock Playhouse, mask mandate lifted, and more. That's all coming up here on Lightning Radio with Bill Moss.
Finding the right insurance doesn't have to be a difficult task. That's where the professionals at Barnett & Coates come in. Family owned and founded back in 1969, you can rest assured that the Barnett & Coates team has a strong insurance background paired with product knowledge to serve you best. From auto, home, business and contractor liability, and business auto to outdoor vehicles and watercraft, with Barnett & Coates, you'll experience the quality service you only find with an independent agency. Barnett & Coates, Spartanburg Highway near Chick-fil-A or at barnettandcoates.com.
Visit Joseph Lauder Clothier in Laurel Park Village and discover the Spring 22 collection of clothing, sportswear, and accessories. Now's the time to get the best selection of 34 Heritage and Peter Millar 5-pocket stretch jeans. Available in denim and lightweight twill. Pair with a Joseph Lauder private label wrinkle-free cotton shirt in long or short sleeves. Bugatti and Marcello offer shirts in unusual prints to be worn in or out. Just arrived cotton PK polo shirts in beautiful pastel colors made in Peru. For spring evenings, choose a lightweight cotton sweater in crew neck, V-neck, and quarter zips worn over a shirt or just a tee. Joseph Lauder Clothier in Laurel Park Village.
Kaysen Builder Supply, the official sponsor of patio season, providing quality landscape and masonry materials, exceptional customer service, and superior delivery from locations in East Flat Rock, Brevard, and Greer. Now is the time to prepare for patio season with a visit to Kaysen Builder Supply in East Flat Rock to see displays of outdoor rooms, pavers, retaining walls, and fire pits. Kaysen Builder Supply, providing exceptional service for over 40 years. The official sponsor of patio season. KaysenCompaniesInc.com.
In today's world, we're all trying to connect faster on more devices at once. Well, I'm happy to share with Q Nation that Optimum has you covered. We have Optimum here at the station and at home. It's faster, more affordable, and more reliable than the other guys. They're now proudly servicing Western North Carolina, delivering blazing fast internet speeds up to 1 gig, 10 times faster than DSL, so you can work, stream, and game faster than ever. Plus, they've got something for everyone in your family to stay entertained with hundreds of TV channels, including many in HD. And with Optimum flexibility, you've got the freedom to choose the products that work for you, and you can change anytime with no forced bundles or annual contracts. So the big question is, what are you waiting for? Visit optimum.com/NC and learn more today. That's optimum.com /NC.
And we are back with Lightning Radio with Bill Moss, editor and publisher of Hendersonville Lightning and HendersonvilleLightning.com, with local news getting behind the headlines of this week's Lightning. Bill, it was last week exactly around this time when we found out about the bomb threat that happened at North Henderson High School, which, of course, they had to evacuate North Henderson and Apple Valley Middle School, but there was a whole lot more involved with it than just that one bomb threat, right?
Yeah, a bunch, and you're exactly right. It was about a half hour ago when the 911 call came in that there was a suspicious package, and there was a telephone bomb threat, and that directed people to where this suspicious package was. And it was, quite the commotion that forced the evacuation of both schools, North Henderson and Apple Valley, the entire campus. And then we waited to see, what's going on? Will they make an arrest? I made a crack that, is it just some student that doesn't want to take a test?
But right.
But it turns out, so they announced this press conference. And I said, they are going to have, it's going to be some kid they were able to trace or whatever. But that's not the reason they called the press conference. When I walked in, I said, "Hi, Sheriff." He said, this one has an interesting twist. And I said, it's not going to be a bomb. It's not going to be an arrest.
Right.
And there is a huge amount of TV crews and everywhere. And Sheriff Lowell Griffin proceeds to say, "We've learned that this event seems to be associated with a disturbing pattern of similar calls from across the state." And it turns out that they believe it. It's my understanding that very similar situations have occurred at, 16 different North Carolina high schools, encompassing 13 different counties, beginning, he said, on April 5, which was only 2 days prior. So
right.
All of these cases, including one, including two nearby, one in Transylvania and one in Rutherford County, had occurred in that short span, and then others with a similar pattern as far away as Tacoma, Washington, and some threats made at some schools in Florida. So it's good in a way because there's a lot of not only state but national and federal resources that he thinks are going to be devoted to trying to figure out what's going on. But in the end, all was safe. There was some amount of fussing, apparently chatter, calls. I don't know if it would have been social media as well, saying, why can't we find out quicker what is going on? And Dr. John Bryant, who also attended and answered questions at the press conference, said, he explained the process of why they didn't have that staging area, which was turned out to be Fruitland Bible College, until later on, and when they could get it all worked out. And he said, as the sheriff said, anytime you're dealing with a crisis situation, the information can't be communicated fast enough. That's always true. Our gold standard is making sure that information is accurate, timely, and that we're certain of what we are communicating. And then to that question, the sheriff raised his hand and said, I just want to add that if we were to prematurely say we're evacuating students to a location before we have secured that location and we're able to secure the routes to that location, when we've got still live,
right,
what they considered a live threat on the campus, we don't want somebody figuring out ahead of time where the students may be headed and how they're going to get there. So, it's all... The answer always is student safety first, and even if the parents inevitably are going to be somewhat anxious and impatient about it.
Which is going to happen, no matter what.
Which is going to happen, and they also, as Sheriff said, we got great parents, we know they love their children, and we know they want to know fast, but we got to keep the children safe first.
Exactly. We can only do what we can do.
Yeah.
Got it. Let's move back to the front page, Bill, and this is something that we featured on Lightning Radio a while back, and the story is back up again, and this is about Canoga Conference Center. They've reached a settlement in that tax exemption case with the county.
Excuse me. Yeah, it's a settlement that is, I guess you say, good in the maybe very short term for Canoga Conference Center, not as good for Canoga Conference Center, the Episcopal Christian Retreat, going forward.
Mm-hmm.
But they did face the possibility of paying just over $1 million in current and back taxes and penalties. It reached a settlement that it will save the retreat $707,000 in this check that they're going to have to write pretty soon, getting that down to $355,982 and shaving off 3 out of the 6 years. This was going back to 2016. So lopping off the first 3 of this 6 years that, that the county tax collector had said it was going to owe for no longer being a nonprofit tax exempt organization. But meaning that they're going to pay not the interest and penalties, but they're going to pay property tax for the tax years 2020, 2021, 2022, and then you can just keep adding the numbers 2023, 2024, 2025 to a fairly well for 90% of their real property and all of their business personal property, which is things like furnishings and equipment.
And the bottom line is, it's because, yes, they are a religious organization, but they hold conferences for perhaps businesses that are not necessarily tax exempt, and that's the reason for this.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that. Let's let the expert, the one who made the, had the authority and did make this decision based on her staff's very thorough investigation, Darlene Burgess, the tax collector, speak to that. Between 2016 and 2021, she told the Board of ENR back in December when the appeal was first heard, many events have been held at Canoga conferences that are inconsistent with the statutory provisions that grant a tax exemption for a religious organization.
Mm-hmm.
Continuing to quote, Canoga uses the property to hold for-profit commercial events open to the general public and inconsistent with the religious-based mission for which the exemption was granted. For instance, on its website, it promotes the lodging for up to 440 guests, the renovated 61-unit Canoga Lake Inn, 39 historic cottages and 6 guest houses, plus meeting space, dining halls, indoor and outdoor chapels, and numerous recreational amenities, including the lake, climbing wall, tennis, shuffleboard, pickleball courts, and miles of hiking and mountain bike trail. So her point was that is more like a for-profit camp or retreat. Camp Bob remains exempt. The sanctuaries, the outdoor chapels, sanctuary course remain exempt. But they have that. But they now will be, again, donors of taxable property.
Right.
Valued in the real property at $17.75 million and business personal at just south of $2 million.
Wow.
So. Good outcome for the county, and I can think of at least one pretty high-profile nonprofit that is also being scrutinized, the Opportunity House.
Yeah.
Also being scrutinized by our tax collector. So I'm not sure, and several others are. So we may hear of more than one other shoe dropping.
Well, I'm sure the lightning's going to be on it. Speaking of being on it, let's hit another couple of stories before we finish up this morning, Bill. Flat Rock Playhouse has dropped their vaccination and mask mandate.
Absolutely correct, yeah. And what we talked about before showtime, a little bit of a surprise. And I guess they must have gotten the authorization from Actors Equity and whoever else runs the Guild for Professional Actors, that not only have they dropped their either proof of vax or negative COVID test requirement,
right,
but mask optional.
Yeah.
Go to the and I have seen big turnouts at the Flat Rock Playhouse for these Music on the Rock shows.
Oh,
there is a pent-up demand for live performing theater.
They have sold out. I talked to numerous people who wanted to go see the Elton John show and couldn't, wanted to see the Neil Diamond show and couldn't, just couldn't get tickets. So there is pent-up demand for it, and it's good to see. And that is even with the mask mandates.
Well, exactly. So this, as the Lightning points out, this change could help the perception of the Playhouse by that medical misinformation caucus that like to run up to the county commission and say, defund the Playhouse, because they have a vaccination passport. Well, there's no vaccination passport.
Right.
There was a need for one back when you could die if you got COVID from from watching a theater performance, but that should help because we're still in the season of budget crafting for the Ennis County Board of Commissions, where they're no longer able to say, well, we'll defund the playhouse because they have a mask mandate.
Because we're not going to let some New York union tell us what we can do on our turf. Exactly.
And that is what was uttered. Yes.
Exactly. So, interesting. I will be interested to find out more about that. Is it, if it's the same way on with other equity theaters? Because of course it was basically the union telling them what
they absolutely could was.
Do.
Yeah, it came from somewhere around Broadway.
Yeah. All right, Bill. Let's finish with we can't be told that there's no new good news anymore. There is always good news. And the Lightning is a very good vessel at shining a light on good news that happens in our community. And you've got a really great Blue Ridge Community College success story here.
Yeah,
let's talk about this.
The volcano of good news, Blue Ridge Community College,
yes,
which
yes.
has all that construction underway,
oh,
which has the state community college president of the year, who is also the Chamber of Commerce education champion of the year.
Well-deserved, both of them, yes.
Which just got $1 million grant for a new, sparkling new greenhouse for its horticulture program, and now has the statewide Community College Dallas Herring Achievement Award winner, Miss Paralee Cox, a soon-to-be surgical tech, who, get this, I can't take credit for it. This is just, it's a news release story that she has overcome tremendous odds raised by parents who allow drugs and violence to be a routine part of the home environment. In and out of foster homes beginning at age 9, Paralee was sentenced in 2014 to 5 years in federal prison for drug-related charges. After earning her GED, she went on to embark on this new career, and she has this Dallas Herring Award, which is based on his philosophy of taking people where they are and carrying them as far as they can go.
Wow.
So congratulations to young Miss Paralee on that tremendous comeback.
Right, and changing her path.
Changing her path.
Absolutely.
And seeing how far she can go.
Bill, let's touch on some Four Seasons politics real quick before we finish up this morning. You got some, of course, always Four Seasons politics in the Lightning.
Yeah, State Senator Chuck Edwards, who is one of the how many? There's a total of 8. So seven candidates challenging United States Congressman Madison Cawthorn in that Republican primary. He touted a couple things of what he described as snowballing momentum of his campaign. A couple of endorsements. One, the North Carolina Police Benevolent Association, announced last week in front of the Asheville Police Department. And then also the well-known Republican activist Stan Shelley. He has joined the Seniors for Chuck movement. And so congratulations, Senator Edwards, there. And then people might want to mark on their calendar down the ballot to another race, the State House District 117 Republican primary, a forum among the three candidates for that,
right,
is going to take place at 9:30 a.m. Saturday, April 30th, at the Cascades Resort on Sugarloaf Road. So if you want to check out what the candidates, Dennis Justice, Jennifer Balcom, and Chelsea Walsh, have to say for themselves for that seat that Tim Moffitt is vacating to run for Senator Edwards' seat, then go reserve your seat by sending an email to NoIRS, that's Mr. Bruce Hatfield, NoIRS@AOL.com.
Fantastic. Bill, we've touched on a lot, but there's still so much more news in this week's Lightning. Where can people go to pick up their Lightning so they can know exactly what's happening in our community?
Well, for the now 10th year in a row, they can go to any of our Lightning Orange racks all around the county, or they can go to the HendersonvilleLightning.com, which has just about all of the stories we talked about today. And clicking on subscribe to join the growing legions of Lightning fans that get their Lightning today, Lightning Thursday, or also easy and fun, call Jan at 828-698-0407.
You've been listening to Lightning Thursday with Bill Moss, editor and publisher of the Hendersonville Lightning and HendersonvilleLightning.com. This program, as well as past episodes, can be heard in their entirety on our website at WTZQ.com. Click on air and scroll down to Lightning Thursday.